Chapter 117. The progress of an epidemic, that it is at least as difficult to stay a moral infection as a physical one, that such a disease will spread with the malignity and rapidity of the plague, that the contagion, when it is once made head, will spare no pursuit or condition, but will lay hold on people in the soundest health, and become developed in the most unlikely constitutions, is a fact as firmly established by experience as that we human creatures breathe an atmosphere. A blessing beyond appreciation would be conferred upon mankind if the tainted, in whose weakness or wickedness these virulent disorders are bred, could be instantly seized and placed in close confinement, not to say summarily smothered, before the poison is communicable. As a vast fire will fill the air to a great distance with its roar, so the sacred flame which the mighty barnacles had fanned caused the air to resound more and more with the name of myrtle. It was deposited on every lip, and carried into every ear. There never was, there never had been, there never again should be, such a man as Mr. Myrtle. Nobody, as aforesaid, knew what he had done, but everybody knew him to be the greatest that had appeared. Down in Bleeding Heart Yard, where there was not one unappropriated halfpenny, as lively an interest was taken in this paragon of men as on the stock exchange. Mrs. Plornish, now established in the small grocery and general trade in a snug little shop at the crack end of the yard, at the top of the steps, with her little old father and Maggie acting as assistants, habitually held forth about him over the counter in conversation with her customers. Mr. Plornish, who had a small share in a small builder's business in the neighborhood, said, trowel in hand, on the tops of scaffolds, and on the tiles of houses, that people did tell him as Mr. Myrtle was the one, mind you, to put us all to rights in respects of that which all on us looked to, and to bring us all safe home as much as we needed, mind you, fur to be brought. Mr. Baptist, sole lodger of Mr. and Mrs. Plornish, was reputed in whispers to lay by the savings which were the result of his simple and moderate life, for investment in one of Mr. Myrtle's certain enterprises. The female bleeding hearts, when they came for ounces of tea and hundredweights of talk, gave Mrs. Plornish to understand that how, ma'am, they had heard from their cousin Mary Ann, which worked in the line, that his lady's dresses would fill three wagons. That how she was as handsome a lady, ma'am, as lived, no matter where's, and a bust like marble itself. That how, according to what they was told, ma'am, it was her son by a former husband as was took into the government, and a general he had been, and armies he had marched again and victory crowned, if all you heard was to be believed. That how it was reported, that Mr. Myrtle's words had been, that if they could have made it worth his while, to take the whole government he would have took it without a profit, but that take it, he could not and stand a loss. That how it was not to be expected, ma'am, that he should lose by it, his ways being, as you might say and utter no falsehood, paved with gold, but that how it was much to be regretted, that something handsome hadn't been got up to make it worth his while, for it was such, and only such, that note the haste to which the bread and butcher's meat had rose, and it was such, and only such, that both could and would bring that haste down. So rife and potent was the fever in Bleeding Heart Yard, that Mr. Pank's rent days caused no interval in the patients. The disease took the singular form, on those occasions, of causing the infected to find an unfathomable excuse and consolation in allusions to the magic name. Now then, ... Mr. Pank's would say, to a defaulting lodger, pay up. Come on. ... I haven't got it, Mr. Pank's, ... defaulter would reply. I tell you the truth, sir, when I say I haven't got so much as a single sixpence of it to bless myself with. ... This won't do, you know, ... Mr. Pank's would retort. You don't expect it will do, do you? ... defaulter would admit, with a low-spirited no, sir, ... having no such expectation. My proprietor isn't going to stand this, you know, apostrophe Mr. Panks would proceed. He don't send me here for this. Pay up. Come. Apostrophe, the defaulter would make answer, ah, Mr. Panks. If I was the rich gentleman whose name is in everybody's mouth, if my name was Myrtle, sir, I'd soon pay up, and be glad to do it. Apostrophe, dialogues on the rent question usually took place at the house doors or in the entries, and in the presence of several deeply interested bleeding hearts. They always received a reference of this kind with a low murmur of response, as if it were convincing, and the defaulter, however black and discomfited before, always cheered up a little in making it. If I was Mr. Myrtle, sir, you wouldn't have cause to complain of me then. No, believe me. Apostrophe, the defaulter would proceed with a shake of the head. I'd pay up so quick then, Mr. Panks, that you shouldn't have to ask me. Apostrophe, the response would be heard again here, implying that it was impossible to say anything fairer, and that this was the next thing to paying the money down. Mr. Panks would be now reduced to saying as he booked the case, well, you'll have the broker in, and be turned out. That's what'll happen to you. It's no use talking to me about Mr. Myrtle. You are not Mr. Myrtle, any more than I am. Apostrophe, no, sir, apostrophe, the defaulter would reply. I only wish you were him, sir. Apostrophe, the response would take this up quickly, replying with great feeling, only wish you were him, sir. Apostrophe, you'd be easier with us, if you were Mr. Myrtle, sir, apostrophe, the defaulter would go on with rising spirits, and it would be better for all parties. Better for our sakes, and better for yours too. You wouldn't have to worry no one, then, sir. You wouldn't have to worry us, and you wouldn't have to worry yourself. You'd be easier in your own mind, sir, and you'd leave others easier too, you would, if you were Mr. Myrtle. Apostrophe, Mr. Panks, in whom these impersonal compliments produced an irresistible sheepishness, never rallied after such a charge. He could only bite his nails and puff away to the next defaulter. The responsive bleeding hearts would then gather round the defaulter whom he had just abandoned, and the most extravagant rumors would circulate among them, to their great comfort, touching the amount of Mr. Myrtle's ready money. From one of the many such defeats of one of many rent days, Mr. Panks, having finished his day's collection, repaired with his notebook under his arm to Mrs. Plornish's corner. Mr. Panks' object was not professional, but social. He had had a trying day, and wanted a little brightening. By this time he was on friendly terms with the Plornish family, having often looked in upon them at similar seasons, and borne his part in recollections of Miss Dorrit. Mrs. Plornish's shop parlor had been decorated under her own eye, and presented, on the side towards the shop, a little fiction in which Mrs. Plornish unspeakably rejoiced. This poetical heightening of the parlor consisted in the wall being painted to represent the exterior of a thatched cottage, the artist having introduced in as effective a manner as he found compatible with their highly disproportionate dimensions, the real door and window. The modest sunflower and hollyhock were depicted as flourishing with great luxuriance on this rustic dwelling, while a quantity of dense smoke issuing from the chimney indicated good cheer within, and also, perhaps, that it had not been lately swept. A faithful dog was represented as flying at the legs of the friendly visitor, from the threshold, and a circular pigeon house, enveloped in a cloud of pigeons, arose from behind the garden paling. On the door, when it was shut, appeared the semblance of a brass plate, presenting the inscription, Happy Cottage, T&M, Plornish, the partnership expressing man and wife. No poetry and no art ever charmed the imagination more than the union of the two in this counterfeit cottage charmed Mrs. Plornish. It was nothing to her that Plornish had a habit of leaning against it as he smoked his pipe after work, when his hat blotted out the pigeon house and all the pigeons, when his back swallowed up the dwelling, when his hands in his pockets uprooted the blooming garden, and laid waste the adjacent country. To Mrs. Plornish, it was still a most beautiful cottage, a most wonderful deception, and it made no difference that Mr. Plornish's eye was some inches above the level of the gable bedroom in the thatch. To come out into the shop after it was shut, and hear her father sing a song inside this cottage, was a perfect pastoral to Mrs. Plornish. The golden age revived. And truly, if that famous period had been revived, or had ever been at all, it may be doubted whether it would have produced many more heartily admiring daughters than the poor woman. Warned of a visitor by the tinkling bell at the shop door, Mrs. Plornish came out of Happy Cottage to see who it might be. "I guessed it was you, Mr. Pancks," apostrophe said she, apostrophe for it's quite the irregular night, ain't it? "Here's father, you see, come out to serve at the sound of the bell, like a brisk young shopman. Ain't he looking well? Father's more pleased to see you than if he was a customer, for he dearly loves a gossip, and when it turns upon Miss Dorrit, he loves it all the more. You never heard father in such voice as he is at present," apostrophe said Mrs. Plornish, her own voice quavering, she was so proud and pleased. "He gave us strephon last night to that degree, that Plornish gets up, and makes him this speech across the table. John Edward Nandy," says Plornish to father, "I never heard you come the warbles as I have heard you come the warbles this night. And it gratifying, Mr. Pancks, though, really?" Apostrophe apostrophe, Mr. Pancks, who had snorted at the old man in his friendliest manner, replied in the affirmative, and casually asked whether that lively ultra chap had come in yet. Mrs. Plornish answered no, not yet, though he had gone to the West End with some work, and had said he should be back by tea time. Mr. Pancks was then hospitably pressed into Happy Cottage, where he encountered the elder Master Plornish just come home from school. Examining that young student, lightly, on the educational proceedings of the day, he found that the more advanced pupils who were in the large text and the letter M, had been set the copy myrtle, millions. Apostrophe, and how are you getting on, Mrs. Plornish? Apostrophe said Pancks, since we're mentioning millions? Apostrophe apostrophe, very steady, indeed, sir, apostrophe returned Mrs. Plornish. Father, dear, would you go into the shop, and tidy the window a little bit before tea, your taste being so beautiful? Apostrophe apostrophe, John Edward Nandy trotted away, much gratified, to comply with his daughter's request. Mrs. Plornish, who was always in mortal terror of mentioning pecuniary affairs before the old gentleman, lest any disclosure she made might rouse his spirit and induce him to run away to the workhouse, was thus left free to be confidential with Mr. Pancks. "It's quite true that the business is very steady indeed," apostrophe said Mrs. Plornish, lowering her voice, "and has a excellent connection. The only thing that stands in its way, sir, is the credit." Apostrophe, this drawback, rather severely felt by most people who engaged in commercial transactions with the inhabitants of Bleeding Heart Yard, was a large stumbling block in Mrs. Plornish's trade. When Mr. Dorrit had established her in the business, the Bleeding Hearts had shown an amount of emotion and a determination to support her in it that did honor to human nature. Recognizing her claim upon their generous feelings as one who had long been a member of their community, they pledged themselves, with great feeling, to deal with Mrs. Plornish, come what would, and bestow their patronage on no other establishment. Influenced by these noble sentiments, they had even gone out of their way to purchase little luxuries in the grocery and butter line to which they were unaccustomed, saying to one another that if they did stretch a point, was it not for a neighbor and a friend, and for whom ought a point to be stretched, if not for such? So stimulated, the business was extremely brisk, and the articles in stock went off with the greatest celerity. In short, if the Bleeding Hearts had but paid, the undertaking would have been a complete success. Whereas, by reason of their exclusively confining themselves to owing, the profits actually realized had not yet begun to appear in the books. Mr. Panks was making a very porcupine of himself by sticking his hair up in the contemplation of this state of accounts, when old Mr. Nandy, re-entering the cottage with an air of mystery, entreated him to come and look at the strange behavior of Mr. Baptist, who seemed to have met with something that had scared him. All three going into the shop and watching through the window, then saw Mr. Baptist, pale and agitated, go through the following extraordinary performances. First, he was observed hiding at the top of the steps leading down into the yard, and peeping up and down the street with his head cautiously thrust out close to the side of the shop door. After very anxious scrutiny, he came out of his retreat, and went briskly down the street, as if he were going away altogether. Then, suddenly turned about, and went, at the same pace, and with the same feint, up the street. He had gone no further up the street than he had gone down, when he crossed the road and disappeared. The object of this last maneuver was only apparent, when his entering the shop with a sudden twist, from the steps again, explained that he had made a wide, and obscure circuit round to the other, or Doyce and Clennam, end of the yard, and had come through the yard and bolted in. He was out of breath by that time, as he might well be, and his heart seemed to jerk faster than the little shop bell, as it quivered and jingled behind him with his hasty shutting of the door. "Hallo, old chap!" said Mr. Panks. "Altro, old boy! What's the matter?" Mr. Baptist, or Signor Cavaletto, understood English now almost as well as Mr. Panks himself, and could speak it very well too. Nevertheless, Mrs. Plornish, with a pardonable vanity in that accomplishment of hers which made her all but Italian, stepped in as interpreter. "He asked no," said Mrs. Plornish, "what go wrong?" "Come into the happy little cottage, Padrona," returned Mr. Baptist, imparting great stealthiness to his flurried backhanded shake of his right forefinger. "Come there." Mrs. Plornish was proud of the title Padrona, which she regarded as signifying not so much mistress of the house, as mistress of the Italian tongue. She immediately complied with Mr. Baptist's request, and they all went into the cottage. "He hope you no fright," said Mrs. Plornish then, interpreting Mr. Panks in a new way with her usual fertility of resource. "What happen? Pica Padrona. I have seen someone," returned Baptist. "I have rincontrado him."
"Him? Who him?"
Asked Mrs. Plornish. "A bad man. A baddest man. I have hoped that I should never see him again."
"How you know him bad?"
Asked Mrs. Plornish. "It does not matter, Padrona. I know it too well."
"He see you?"
Asked Mrs. Plornish.
"No. I hope not. I believe not."
Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.